And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, let's start out with a quote from Hunter S. Thompson. Going to trial with a lawyer who considers your whole lifestyle a crime in progress is not a happy prospect. That being said, in February 2015, a light dusting of snow fell on the Amsterdam suburb of Harlem in New York City. Concerned neighbors in a row of townhouses called police to report that one of the townhouses had no snow on its roof. Well, the Dutch police had seen this happen before. They had a pretty good idea what the cause was. They investigated and found out they were correct. The hot lights from a large-scale cannabis operation in the attic had melted the snow. Well, the occupants of the home were arrested and the plants were confiscated. Now, if they'd have waited till spring, nobody would have known the difference. Well, in 2013, a Brooklyn entrepreneur con man named Howard Leventhal convinced investors he had invented a medical tricorder, like the device that Dr. McCoy uses on Star Trek to scan his patients. Leventhal, who was 56, called it the Healthio McCoy Home Health Tablet. The wireless device supposedly works something similar to what you saw on Star Trek. You scan yourself, and vital information about your health is instantly sent to the company's nurse staff call center. Now, though Leventhal had no prototype or even schematics for the device, he got $800,000 to develop it. But there was nothing to develop. He had made the whole thing up. Well, shortly he got arrested, and at his hearing, he pleaded guilty, lamenting, "I'd like to move to Mars, but the option didn't open." Well, interestingly enough, Dr. McCoy actor DeForest Kelly's final role was the voice in the 1998 animated feature, The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars. Well, you know, Dr. McCoy always said he was a doctor, not a whatever it was that Kirk wanted him to be. Unfortunately, it wasn't a case where Dr. Heal yourself. He did die. If you wrote the Turner Diaries, you'd keep your identity secret, and that's now William Luther Pierce used the name Andrew McDonald in 1978 when he wrote a book dubbed The Bible of the Racist Right by the FBI. The bizarre racist sci-fi adventure, The Turner Diaries, is set in the year 2099. According to the diary, its protagonist, Earl Turner, describes how he and fellow members of a terrorist group known as the Organization had brought down the American government and instituted a worldwide race war that ultimately eliminated all Jews and non-whites. It's unhinged, it's paranoid stuff, and it's sold about 500,000 copies so far. Dr. William Luther Pierce III, he died in 2002, was an assistant professor of physics at Oregon State University in the 60s and one-time leader of the National Alliance, a white separatist group associated with the American Nazi Party, whose racist rhetoric made the KKK look tame by comparison. Pierce was also the founder of Cosmotheism, a religion based on white racial superiority and eugenics. Among other things, the Turner Diaries is credited with influencing acts of violence and terrorism, including the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh, a known admirer of the book. When Pierce died of cancer in July of 2002, he was hailed as a prophet by some and as an inflammatory racist scaremonger by others. Well, for a man who saw life in black and white, he couldn't have expected anything less. Well, in the late 1860s, the term mafia muscled its way into dictionaries. But long before in Sicily, everybody knew what that word meant. It originated in the tough streets and slums of Palermo, Italy. A man who was a mafioso was a man of respect, prepared to take the law into his own hands to right perceived wrongs. America's learned the word mafia when it traveled to America along with the flood of immigrants from Italy in the late 19th and early 20th century. In America, mafia meant organized crime. Well, the... You know, sometimes you've heard the expression, tough pills to swallow. In August of 2017, police in the town of Osnabrück, Germany, pulled over a 51-year-old father and his 17-year-old son for suspect license plates. Well, the pair were acting suspicious, so the police searched the car and found 5,000 orange ecstasy pills in the shape of President Donald Trump's head. Now, you got to wonder about that. In 2015, more than 120 statues of Shaun the Sheep, the beloved British cartoon character from Wallace and Gromit, were scattered through Bristol and London, urging people to donate to local children's hospitals. Give enough money and you could own one of those sculptures. But for only £10, you could own a Shaun the Sheep ecstasy pill. Now, it wasn't part of the charity drive, but rather an attempt by some deranged drug dealers to cash in on the campaign. Several Shaun tablets were seized by detectives, but the distributor of the pills was never found. Well, Ted Kaczynski, the man whose case the FBI dubbed Unabomber for University and Airline Bomber, set off 16 homemade explosive devices between 1978 and 1995 that killed three people, maimed nearly two dozen others. Now, his infamous manifesto shed light on two predominant themes that bounced around his brilliant but apparently sick brain, a disdain for technology and a love of nature. After bluntly leaving academia in the 1970s to live in a cabin in the woods, he might have stayed there had bulldozers not raised the land around his Montana homestead. Because that's when the bombings began. But the bad seed that led to the bombings may have been sowed a whole lot earlier. As a Harvard sophomore in 1959, Kaczynski participated in a twisted research study led by famed psychologist Henry Murray, who in World War II had trained U.S. spies to withstand intense interrogation. In the Harvard study, Murray's 22 subjects were told to write an essay outlining their personal philosophy, which would be later debated by a fellow student. Instead, Kaczynski, a 17-year-old child genius, was strapped to a chair under intense lights and electrodes were hooked to his head. Then from behind a one-way mirror, a camera recorded his angry facial expressions as a lawyer read back his essay, exploiting every perceived weakness, insulting and berating him relentlessly. Later, the footage of Kaczynski's reactions are played back to him ad nauseum. Murray's method of destructive psychology was by design vehement, sweeping, and personally abusive. Now, opinion is divided as to how much this three-year study directly led to Kaczynski's crimes, but consider, if you will, Henry Murray's theory of personality states in part that an individual's personality develops dynamically as each person responds to complex elements in his or her specific environment. And Kaczynski's response to complex elements was bizarre, to say the least. His targets, whom he called agents of anti-human technology, were university and airline officials with nature-themed names like Thomas Mosser, Percy Wood, and Leroy Wood Bearson. Included in Kaczynski's crew bombs were pieces of wood and moss. Now, who knows how many more people might have suffered had the FBI not published the Unabomber's Manifesto in 1995. Kaczynski's estranged brother David read it and recognized it as something that Ted had written. So he called the FBI and the Unabomber was arrested and sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole. Had David not tipped them off, they couldn't have found their rear end with both hands and a flashlight, as shown by their current activities, or lack thereof. Well, let's talk about something that you might refer to as Miami Vice. The perpetrators were several officers in Miami, Florida. July 29, 1985, a group of men were attacked on a boat in the Miami River in the city's Little Havana district. Several of the men were thrown or perhaps jumped overboard, and three died by drowning. An investigation found the men had been unloading roughly 400 kilos of cocaine when the attack occurred. And further investigation revealed the attackers were Miami cops. They were in uniform when they made the raid. Well, instead of arresting the suspects and taking the cocaine in as evidence, they took the cocaine and sold it on the street, making about $116,000 in the process. Still more investigation revealed that this same group of corrupt cops had pulled off similar drug heists as well as a host of other crimes over the years. Well, eventually, 34 members of the Miami Police Department were arrested, some of whom agreed to testify against the others in exchange for immunity. During the course of the trial, several of the arrested cops hired a hitman to murder the key witnesses against them. That didn't work out too well. Can't find a good hitman anymore. When it was all over, 24 Miami cops were convicted and 17 went to prison. The longest sentence went to the leader of the group, Officer Osvaldo Coelho, who got 35 years. And writers for the television crime drama, Miami Vice, actually based several episodes of the TV show on the scandal. Never let a scandal go to waste. Well, sometimes the best laid plans of Mice and Gilberto Escamilla don't quite go as expected. In his case, everything is going according to plan until 800 pounds of fajitas came crashing down on him. Usually when people steal things from their workplace, they take pens or paper clips or sometimes paper. But when you're Gilberto Escamilla, you take fajitas. And lots of them. He'd been working in the kitchen of a South Texas juvenile justice department for over 9 years when he decided to take a day off work for a medical appointment. While he was out, a driver for Labatt Food Service called the kitchen and let him know he had 800 pounds of fajitas to deliver. Well, the employee who answered the phone was a little confused. That kitchen didn't serve fajitas. And the driver informed her he'd been delivering fajitas to that department for nearly 10 years. Well, when Escamilla returned to work the next day, he was questioned about the food delivery. And that's when he admitted he'd been stealing the fajitas, paid for by the county, for the past 9 years. Apparently, Escamilla would sell his food to his outside customers the day he ordered it. Officials got a search warrant and searched his house, only to find packages of the fajitas in Escamilla's refrigerator. Well, he was fired first, and then he was arrested for stealing somewhere between $2,500 and $30,000 worth of fajitas. The ex-kitchen employee posted bond and got released from jail, but the event wasn't over yet. After reviewing documents such as purchase orders and invoices for the past 9 years, the district attorney's office determined Escamilla had scammed the Justice Department out of over $1 million in fajitas. That's a first-degree theft felony. According to Cameron County District Attorney Louis Sayens, if it wasn't so serious, you'd think it was a Saturday Night Live skit, but this was the real thing. Escamilla was arrested once again, and I guess you could say justice was served, and there are many who would say it was delicious. Well, some swear the tale of the Beans cannibal family is true. Some call it the ultimate urban legend, but tales about Shawnee Bean and his family refused to die. According to legend, Shawnee Bean raised 3 inbred generations on the coast of Gallows in Scotland in the 15th century. And he sustained his huge family by attacking, robbing, and killing, and eating travelers who passed by the family cave. Now, at first, he took only the odd traveler. But as the decades passed and his clan grew, they needed more food, so the death toll began to rise. When local villagers discovered odd preserved bits of bodies washing up on the shore near the cave, they hunted for the murderer. And eventually, Bean and his family were discovered and publicly burned for their crimes on the order of King James of Scotland. Now, the story may seem hard to believe to those of us in this country, but Scottish and British kids know all about it. Their mothers used tales of the Beans to scare their kids into being good. And that story was the basis for Wes Craven's 2006 film, The Hills Have Eyes. You just never know what you're going to find when you wander around in the woods. Well, let's turn to Syracuse, New York. While officers were investigating a 2012 bank robbery in Syracuse, the robber, Arthur Bundridge, 28, returned to the bank and tried to get in the front door as the police had locked. Well, you have to ask why he would come back to the scene of the crime. Well, the teller had shortchanged him. He had demanded $20,000, and the teller gave him less than that. So he came back for the difference. Can't blame him. In 2012, a Twin Falls, Idaho police officer stopped a man who was acting suspiciously and asked him for his name and birthday. He said Emiliano Valesco and gave a date. Well, the search of that name came up empty, and that's when the police saw the name Contreras tattooed on his arm. That's when the police officer ran the name that was tattooed on his arm with the birthday given, and up popped the name Dylan Edward Contreras, 19. He had 3 outstanding warrants for failure to appear and for giving false information. You know, sometimes it's not what you say, it's what you show. Well, how about Munchausen by proxy? Her name is Gypsy Rose Blanchard. Gypsy because her mother, Dee Dee, had always liked that name, and Rose because her father, Rod, had always liked Guns N' Roses. Now, that dubious reasoning marked the beginning of a tumultuous life that would land Gypsy Rose in prison for the murder of her mother, who was found stabbed to death in her Missouri home in 2015. And the events that led up to the murder read like something out of a twisted David Lynch movie. Rod split not long after Gypsy was born, leaving Dee Dee to raise her daughter alone. And although Gypsy was a healthy girl, her mother convinced her she wasn't healthy at all. That though she was a teenager, she only had the mental capacity of a 7-year-old. And she also convinced Gypsy and her entire family that Gypsy had leukemia, asthma, and muscular dystrophy. And she even fooled a few doctors into performing unnecessary surgeries on the girl. Well, at the height of the ruse, the Make-A-Wish Foundation was sending Gypsy, who was wheelchair-bound, to Disney World and to Miranda Lambert concerts. But there was nothing medically wrong with Gypsy, and every time she tried to say that, Dee Dee physically abused her. And even worse, Dee Dee put Botox in Gypsy's saliva glands to make her drool and stuck tubes in her ear to give her ear infections. It wasn't until Gypsy was in her early 20s that she was able to get away. Met her boyfriend at a science fiction convention and eventually decided the only way to be free was to kill Dee Dee and flee the state. So they did. Now, they were later caught and sent to prison. Now, Dee Dee Blanchard suffered, for lack of a better word, from an actual condition known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy. In the most common Munchausen syndrome, named for an 18th-century German man who embellished his life story, the sufferer believes they suffer from one or more chronic illnesses. In this particular case, the proxy was Rose, whom Dee Dee was convinced was sick. And she managed to convince everybody else as well. Well, as Dee Dee put it during an interview she granted in prison, I think Dee Dee would have been the perfect mother for somebody who really was sick. Well, when you hear a story like this, you know what Voltaire was talking about when he said history is nothing but a parade of crimes and adversities. And it's pretty much the case. Well, you know, the legal system goes to great lengths to classify lawbreakers, but some are really difficult to classify. In 2002, Luke Helder, University of Wisconsin art student, was arrested for planting 18 pipe bombs on mailboxes in a half a dozen states. It's all part of a bizarre art project. When plotted on a map, the bomb sites formed a smiley face with the eyes in Nebraska and Iowa and the left side of the mouth in Colorado and Texas. The right side remained unfinished because the police called Helder after his father turned him in. Can't trust anybody. Luckily, nobody died. Well, Simon Andrews of Osbaldwick, England, was sentenced to 6 months house arrest in 2003. One more time. The crime, Andrews had attacked 4 random men on the street, wrestling them to the ground and taken off, but not stealing their shoes and socks. Why'd he do it? Well, Andrews, who was an accountant, says he was just stressed out, and this was a way to relieve the stress. Well, A couple living in Dorset, England, called the police in 2001 when they realized their home had been broken into while they were out. Well, the investigation revealed the thief actually hadn't stolen anything, but it had left behind a new television and an unopened bottle of Zima. You have to wonder why a new television was left. Maybe he didn't like the old one. Well, not everyone appreciates creativity in the courtroom. The plaintiff was Robert Lee Brock. The defendant was Robert Lee Brock. Now, Brock was an inmate serving 23 years for grand larceny, and he filed a $5 million lawsuit against himself. He claimed he violated his own religious beliefs and civil rights by forcing himself to get drunk. And because of his self-induced drunkenness, he perpetuated several crimes. He claimed, "I want to pay myself $5 million for violating my rights," and asked the state to pay it since I can't work and I'm a ward of the state. It was a very creative approach to the matter. Unfortunately for him, the court dismissed the case. In the next one, Ned Searight sued the state of New Jersey. In a $14 million lawsuit, he claimed he'd suffered injuries while in prison in 1962. Well, he charged he was injected with a radium electric beam against his will. As a result, he began hearing voices in his head. Well, the claim was dismissed on the ground that the statute of limitations had run out. And a judge also offered a bit of a strange lesson in physics. Taking the facts as pleaded, they show a case of presumable unlicensed radio communication that comes within the sole jurisdiction of the FCC. And even aside from that, Searight could have blocked the broadcast to the antenna in his brain simply by grounding it. Searight might have pinned to the back of a trouser leg a short chain of paper clips so the end would touch the ground and prevent anybody from talking to him inside his brain. Well, in 2016, Chicago's murder rate rose a whopping 60% higher than the year before, which brought the Windy City's murder rate to 27.7 homicides per 100,000 people. Well, despite that huge increase, it still was behind St. Louis, which claimed the top murder rate of 2016 at a mind-blowing 60 murders per 100,000 residents. So, for every 100,000 people, you got 60 folks need to go hide. Well, movie actor and comedian Thelma Todd was found dead in her garage. The question was she murdered? Now, 2 days before her body was found in her garage, Thelma Todd had been at a party at the Cafe Trocadero on Sunset Boulevard. And Todd was well known for her hard-partying ways. She drank heavily that night and stayed out until 2:45 in the morning. And afterward, her chauffeur drove her home. In fact, he was the last known person to see her alive. Now, Todd's life was full of drama and crime. She was attracted to powerful men, and gangsters Pat DiCicco and Lucky Luciano intrigued her. Todd actually married DiCicco in 1932, and DiCicco introduced her to Luciano. And with her husband off and away, Thelma became Luciano's lover. Well, the former Flame and co-star Roland West proposed that Thelma Todd open a joint venture restaurant on Sunset Boulevard. 1934, Thelma Todd's Sidewalk Cafe opened up for business. A three-story building housed the restaurant on the main floor, a private bar on the second, and storage on the third. West ran the place, and Todd's fame drew the crowds. Well, Todd divorced DiCicco in 1934, but her relationship with Luciano wasn't so easily dissolved. He insisted on opening an illegal gambling parlor on the building's third floor, which Todd was totally opposed to. Luciano tried to persuade West and Todd by sending his associates to repeat his demands. Well, Todd decided to fight back. She made an appointment with the district attorney's office for December 17th, one day after she died. She was ready to spill all she knew about the mobster. She also planned to audit the cafe's financial records. Because busy as it was, and it was full every single night, it wasn't making money. And West and the cafe's treasurer weren't giving her the answer she demanded. Apparently, they were being intimidated by Luciano and were actually paying protection. Well, Thelma Todd's body was found December 16, 1935. On December 19th, the grand jury convened. With national media camped outside, the jury called more than 40 witnesses to explain the circumstances that led up to Todd's death. Well, the jury, after hearing the evidence, ruled her death accidental. The ruling presumed that an intoxicated Todd took refuge in her car after having been locked out of her apartment, possibly by Roland West. Maybe she turned on the engine and for warmth and fell asleep. But that wouldn't explain the blood and bruises found on her body or her cracked ribs. Among the leading suspects were the three men in Todd's life, Luciano, West, and DeCicio. And their motives were clear. Luciano wanted his legal casino and orchestrated her murder to get it. He also appeared to have known about Todd's appointment with the DA. Roland West came under suspicion as a jealous ex-lover or a greedy business partner. And Todd's ex-husband, Pat DeCicio, drew police attention because he tried to convince Todd to involve him in the steakhouse venture. Now, there was no hard evidence to link any of them to her death, and nobody was ever arrested. And the full story behind her death remains a complete mystery to this day. But clearly, with blood, bruises, and cracked ribs, something more than just keeping warm was involved in her death. Well, let's talk about a few real-life examples of unusual legal battles that did involve celebrities. The plaintiff, Florence Henderson. The defendant, Serial Killer Incorporated. Henderson, the actor who played Carol Brady on the TV show The Brady Bunch, sued clothing maker Serial Killer in 1999 when they put out a T-shirt that showed her picture with the caption, Porn Queen. The suit called the caption highly offensive and false. The verdict? Serial Killer pulled all the offending merchandise out of stores the day after the suit was filed. So what does that mean? Well, apparently there was no verdict per se, but Florence Henderson got what she wanted. Now, this next case, the plaintiffs are Anna Kournikova and Judith Soletz Benetton. The defendant was Penthouse Magazine. Penthouse published photos it claimed were taken of Kournikova, a top-ranked Russian tennis player, bathing topless. Kournikova denied it was her and threatened to sue. But the magazine's editor said they had studied the photos in painstaking detail and refused to back down. It seemed that Penthouse might win the case till Soletz Benetton of the Benetton clothing family came forward and said she was actually the woman in the photos. And then she sued for $10 million. You know, Penthouse settled out of court. And it was a secrecy agreement, so we don't know who got what, but apparently everybody came off happy except Penthouse. Let's talk about Bernie Madoff, the mastermind of the largest financial fraud scheme in American history. And after his empire crumbled, people wanted a piece of the rubble. A blue satin New York Mets baseball team jacket with Madoff stitched on the back in orange went up for auction. Team owner Fred Wilpon was one of Madoff's victims. The estimated value of the jacket, $720. But it sold for $14,500. How about a Lady Hermes brown suede handbag that belonged to Madoff's wife, Ruth, plus two other purses? Estimated value, $210. Sold for $1,900. Well, how about three boogie boards? One with Madoff written on it with black marker. Estimated to be worth $80. Sold for $1,000. How about a set of Madoff's personalized golf clubs? The irons only. Estimated value, $350. Actually sold for $3,600. A pair of Ruth Madoff's diamond Victorian dangle earrings. Estimated value, $20,000. Sold for $70,000. Another item up for auction was a 1960 Hofstra University ring engraved with BM. Estimated value, $360. Sold for $6,000. Then the last item we have information on is a black leather Mont Blanc wallet embossed with BM. Estimated to be worth $100. Sold for $2,200. People tend to go nuts when there's a auction. Let's talk about the murder of Chico Mendez. First, I thought I was fighting to save rubber trees, and I realized I was fighting to save the Amazon rainforest. Now I realize I'm fighting for humanity. That was a quote from Chico Mendez. As the son of a family of rubber tappers, now those are workers who gather latex from rubber trees in Brazil, Chico Mendez became a tapper when he was only 9 years old. Now that's a hard job because you wander through the jungle and you find rubber trees and you take a hammer and what's known as a tap and you drive the tap into the tree to get the sap, and then you stand there while that's the sap run into a bucket. Then you carry the bucket to wherever you're supposed to take it. When prices for rubber collapsed in the 1960s, many Amazon landowners began auctioning their land to cattle ranchers who promptly cut the trees down to convert the acreage for grazing. Alarmed, Mendez campaigned to save the trees by running for local auction. He proposed creating forest reserves managed by the people who lived there and founded the Jurupari Rural Workers Union to unite rubber tappers and rally them to resist ranchers. And he raised consciousness about the global dangers of deforestation. Directly as a result of his actions, 8 million acres of Amazon forest were saved. In 1988, he led a successful campaign to stop rancher Darley Alves de Silva from logging in an area designated to become a reserve. Later that year, Mendez was assassinated at age 44, and his murder made headlines around the globe. Alves de Silva's son and one of their ranch hands were arrested, convicted, and imprisoned for the crime. Prior to his murder, Mendez said in an interview he wanted to live, but if a messenger from the sky came down and guaranteed my death would strengthen our struggle, it'd be worth it. In that show, sometimes you need to be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. Well, in 2002, just a few months after the 9/11 attacks, a bizarre message flashed on a U.S. Army computer screen. Your security system is crap. I'm solo. I'll continue to disrupt at the highest levels. The message appeared on 97 Army, Navy, Air Force, and NASA computers. Officials immediately suspected, and in fact, they were afraid that it was a terrorist attack. It wasn't. Security experts tracked the messages to Scotland, where they'd been sent out by a man named Gary McKinnon. His lawyer's defense, McKinnon had an Asperger's syndrome, a condition marked by an inability to understand simple social cues, but an enhanced ability to understand complex systems such as computer networks. Well, McKinnon had actually hacked into the military networks because he believed that's where the U.S. government was storing the truth about UFOs. U.S. government asked the U.K. to extradite McKinnon for trial, but in 2012, that's 10 years of after 10 years of legal wrangling, extradition was denied. McKinnon went unpunished, but he never did find out about the UFOs. Well, let's talk about Jimmy Hoffa. He was a well-known union leader in the 60s and 70s, and July 30th, 1975, he had dinner at a restaurant in Detroit. So he had been the head of the union, Teamsters Union. Bobby Kennedy got him sent to prison, and eventually somebody else took over as president. Originally, the president was a puppet for Jimmy, but then he decided he was president, so he'd do as he wanted to. When Jimmy got out, he wanted to be president again, and he was working on doing that very thing. Well, after his dinner at the restaurant in Detroit, he vanished. After 7 years, he was declared legally dead. Over 40 years later, actually now 45, federal agents are still looking for him. In 1975, detectives inspected a trash compactor at the Raleigh house, theorizing the mobsters used it to crush Hoffa's body before carting it off to in a mafia-related garbage service. Didn't find him. In 1989, Donald Tony the Greek Franco said he'd been part of the hit team that murdered Hoffa. Franco said they dismembered the body and shipped it to New Jersey in an oil drum where it was buried into one of the end zones in Giant Stadium. No, the feds never followed up. When the stadium was demolished in 2010, they didn't find Hoffa. 2004, a criminal named Frank Sheeran admitted he'd killed Hoffa in a Detroit house in 1975. Two retired Detroit police detectives searched the house that had been pointed out by Sheeran. They claimed they found traces of blood on some of the floorboards, so authorities searched the property. They didn't find Hoffa or any of his blood. 2013, the FBI got a tip from a man who reportedly had mob ties who said Hoffa's body was buried in a field outside of Detroit. Again, a search was conducted. They didn't find anything. And the Juggaloos are a gang of axe-murdering clowns who worship the rap band Insane Clown Posse. Well, that's the general impression of them anyway, but most Juggaloos maintain they're misunderstood. According to Juggaloo Patrick Flannery, it isn't fair just because this group depicts violent images and talks about very crude murder scenarios. But all that being said, there have been quite a few strange crimes associated with the group. One case, a Juggaloo cut off a woman's pinky toe and drank her blood. And two Juggaloos threw feces at Tila Tequila during a concert. But it's not all fun and games, though. Roughly 15% of America's 1 million Juggaloos are members of actual gangs, and they've been known to commit really gruesome murders with hatchets and other sharp objects. So it's not surprising in 2011 that the FBI classified the Juggaloos as a gang. At first, Insane Clown Posse co-founder Shaggy 2 Dope thought the classification was pretty dope. That means good for those that aren't up on gang slang. But he changed his tune when he found out the non-gang affiliated Juggaloos were getting hit with harsher sentences for petty crimes. So the band sued the FBI to have their dope name restored and even held a rally in Washington, D.C. in 2017. They said, "We truly are a family that's united by a shared love of music and fellowship." Well, as of last report, though, the Juggaloos are still on the gang list. So if a scary clown approaches you in a dark alley, you're supposed to ask, are you a good Juggaloo or are you a bad Juggaloo? If you don't do that, you can be accused of being politically incorrect and possibly racist. And whatever you do, don't ask them, do they have Kung Flu? Well, successful felonies aren't as easy to commit as you might think. They require a little foresight. Well, in 2007, a man walked into a 7-Eleven in Monrovia, Maryland, just past midnight and attempted a holdup. The unidentified man didn't have a gun or a weapon of any kind. He merely demanded the clerk give him the money. The clerk refused, so the man started picking up items off the counter to use as a weapon. After repeatedly hitting the clerk with a banana, the attacker fled empty-handed before the police got there. And I guess you can ask yourself, why would he use a banana? Well, apparently as a weapon, it had a certain appeal. In 2007, the Seattle Museum hosted Bodies, the Exhibition, an educational display of preserved corpses and internal organs. One of the display kidneys was stolen. Police are still searching for the culprit, but don't fear the kidney will turn up on the black market, because even though the kidney is real, it's not usable. It's been filled and covered with plastic resin. That would tend to cause an issue if it was put into somebody. Well, the Lindau man had definitely been murdered, and there's no statute of limitations on murder. The victim's skull was bashed in, he was strangled, his neck broken, and his throat was slashed. His ultra-violent end stirred international interest. But there was no cry for the cops to find his killer. You see, he died in 100 A.D. and he'd been bogged down, so to speak, in the Lindau Moss Bog for nearly 2,000 years. Now, if perchance his killer was in the bog as well, I know a silly-ass judge here who would want to put him up on trial. Well, scientists swarmed over the Lindau man using modern forensics to follow a crime trail almost 2,000 years old. They can't solve local crimes that happened last week, but they're trying to solve one that's 2,000 years old. Examining the victim, they learned he was about 5'5" and weighed about 160 pounds. He's between 25 and 30 years old, muscular and in good health on his last day on Earth. And he was naked except for a fox fur armband, but traces of fox fur in the bog made it likely he'd once worn a fox fur cape. Well, Pete, as they're referring to him, was likely a man of high rank. He was well-fed and sleekly groomed. Had close-cropped hair, mustache, and sideburns that were all preserved by the bog. His skin was decorated, but it was smooth, minus any scars might indicate he'd been a warrior. And he's referred to as Pete Marsh. Was not a peasant. He had well-manicured fingernails on hands and never did much manual labor. He'd eaten burned griddle cakes at his last meal, and there were traces of mistletoe pollen in his stomach as well. Well, some scholars believe the Lindau man was actually a druid. After they were conquered by the Romans, the druids disappeared, leaving no written records behind. Roman writers reported that druids painted their skin, used mistletoe plant in their sacred rituals, and sacrificed human beings to their gods to ensure fertility. Now, those practices would tend to make druids our number one suspect for the murder of the Lindau man. Beginning with his last meal, his last day went downhill from there. His last vision may have been an axe or a hammer hitting him in the head. Once unconscious, he was strangled or garroted with enough force to break his neck vertebra. After he was strangled, a blade sliced his throat, draining him of blood, and he was dumped face down in the bog. Well, some historical investigators make the case that Lindau's man violently was a punishment for a crime. But others believe his last meal that included mistletoe, which was sacred to the druids, along with his triple killing and burial in the bog, are proof of a human sacrifice to the Celtic gods. Well, the Lindau's man had been freeze-dried to keep it mummified. His face had been reconstructed based on radiographs of his skull, and he turns out to be a fairly good-looking guy. His face isn't primitive or savage, and he could easily be a guy you'd meet in the modern streets of London. He stays indoors these days in a dim, quiet corner of London's British Museum. But the case can be made that he was a very early murder victim. Well, there was a look-alike licking windows. And who did the look-alike look like? Noel Gallagher. After several eyewitnesses alerted the Swinton, England police about the Oasis, a lead singer's strange doppelganger in October 2017, the police put an alert on their Facebook page. They said, you know it's going to be one of those shifts when you get a report of a Noel Gallagher look-alike swigging from a bottle of White Lightning and licking windows. Well, that post drew a lot of attention and amassed several hundred likes and shares, and that prompted the department to release an official statement. We've received reports of a man resembling Noel Gallagher in Swindon at around 5:30 p.m. yesterday who appeared to be under the influence of alcohol and was licking windows. Not a wonder wall, and he may have been half the world away. The incident was nowhere near the Oasis, but in the town center near the Wyvern Theater. If anybody heard or saw anything suspicious in the area, please don't look back in anger, but contact us on 101. Well, even the real Noel Gallagher got in the act, responded with an Instagram. Now, to do with me, mate, I'm still away on holiday. Well, last report, the White Lightning swigging window licker was still at large. And if you see somebody licking a window, you know that it may give him a pain, you know. Quote from Marilyn Manson. From Jesse James to Charles Manson, the media since their inception have turned criminals into folk heroes. And that from Marilyn Manson, a strange person in his own right. Well, let's talk about Bell Guinness. Born in Selbu, Norway in 1859. At the age of 22, she came to America, got married, and opened a candy shop with her husband. A year later, the store burned down, the first of what would be several suspicious fires in Bell's life. The couple collected an insurance payout and bought a new house. 15 years later, in 1898, that house burned down and another insurance payment was issued. Now, this time, 1900, another insurance policy was brought into play, but this time it was life insurance. Her husband died under mysterious, suspicious circumstances. In 1902, Bell married a local butcher named Peter Gunness. One week later, Peter Gunness' infant daughter died while alone with Bell. Another insurance policy was cashed out. And 8 months later, Peter Gunness was dead. Bell told the police a meat grinder had fallen from a shelf and crushed her husband in the skull. The coroner ruled the cause of death to be murder. She denied killing her husband, and a jury found her innocent. Well, she put ads in newspapers around the Midwest soliciting gentlemen who were interested in joining fortunes. The ads work, and suitors begin to show up at the farm. John Moo arrived with his life savings. He stayed at the farm for a week and vanished. Over the years, several more met the same fate. Henry Gerholt had brought $1,500. Old Brudsberg, who brought the deed to his property and was last seen in the LaPorte Bank, and Andrew Hegelin, who was last seen in the bank. A few weeks later, after Andrew's disappearance, his brother, A.K. Hegelin, wrote to Guinness to inquire about him. She replied he'd gone to Norway. Hegelin didn't believe her and threatened to come to LaPorte to find him. Well, in 1908, Guinness's farm burned down. Inside were four bodies, three of Guinness's children and a headless corpse. Well, upon further investigation, it became clear the mystery body couldn't be that of Guinness. She was significantly taller than the corpse, even adding in some height for the missing head. Search of the farm revealed five dismembered corpses buried about the property. Well, people reported seeing Bell Guinness at dozens of locations around the country over the following decades. 1931, a woman named Esther Carlson was arrested for the poisoning murder of her husband in L.A. She looked a lot like Bell Guinness. Carlson died awaiting trial, but some report residents made the trip to L.A. morgue to view the body. They all swore it was Guinness. Maybe it was. Too late to do any good. Well, if you want some interesting reading, check out the police blotters in your local newspaper. I got some stories for you. A woman reported that somebody entered her condo, tied her shoelaces together, tilted pictures on the wall, and removed the snaps from her clothing. Don't that take the rag off in the bush? A resident called police after finding a 12-pack of toilet paper on her doorstep on Green Ridge Drive, and that wasn't the first time she found it. Right now, with everybody on lockdown and toilet paper in scarce supply, that might be a good thing to have happen. At 11:50 p.m., police talked to four nude people seen running down Lincoln Street and advised them not to be nude in public again. You know, at 11:50 p.m., it can get to be kind of cool. The glass to a snack machine at the Knott Hall commuter lounge was reported to be broken. Campus police responded and moved all the remaining snacks. Well, they get hungry. Clinton police responded quickly to an accident in the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts. That prompt response is credited to there being a squad car waiting in line in a drive-up window. It's like Fluffy, who was pulling out of a donut parking lot. He just bought a dozen donuts. And he was pulled over, and the officer walked up to the window and said, "You know why I stopped you?" And he pointed to the box of donuts and said, "Yeah, you smelled them."
A man reported a burglar about 10 p.m. Thursday after he came home and found his 36-inch Samsung TV missing. It had been replaced with an RCA TV.
Decorative items are placed around the new TV in an apparent attempt to fool him. I don't understand what the difference is unless there was something intrinsic about it.
Well, the mother of an adult man called police concerned he was running with the wrong crowd. Maybe he was running with three other nude people down the street at 11:50 in the evening. Who knows? Well, sometimes laws don't make sense. Rotting fish, manhandling a mango, and coin management are some of the subjects covered by Canadian jurisprudence. It's illegal anywhere in Canada to pay for something with just pennies if the total's more than 25 cents. You can't pay with only nickels for something over $5, or in all dimes if the cost is more than $10. You can fish in some of the lakes and streams of Canada's national parks, but if you catch rots, you've broken the law. I would hate to catch a rot. Well, check in your old closet. It's illegal to own a comic book that exclusively or substantially depicts crimes, real or fictitious. Now, whoever submitted that particular law to the legislature had too much time on their hands. And you can't manhandle fresh produce in British Columbia until after you've paid for it. Who knows where those hands have been? Now, engaging in a duel isn't specifically against the law in Canada, but challenging somebody to a duel, inciting another to challenge someone, or accepting a challenge is definitely against the law. So if you just somehow telepathically agree to take part in a duel, that's okay. Now, keep them in the backyard where they belong. Toronto forbids crocodiles or alligators, no matter how small or large, to be inside a private home. Now, I would think that is a violation of, here in this country, be a violation of your First Amendment. You have every right to have an alligator, no matter how big, in your house. Well, got a wound? Don't change your bandage in public. It'll cost you a pretty penny. Literally, the maximum fine is 1 cent. See all those glossy ads for Viagra? An old Canadian law says you can be prosecuted if you advertise a product that enhances or improves sexual performance. Now, there is a loophole. You can skirt the law if you can prove the public good was served by the advertisement. I don't even want to go there. Well, Gene Crump, 67, and Faye Schilling, 61, masterminded an insurance scam that was as morbid as it was clever. The two women worked out of the Steward Pierce Mortuary in Los Angeles. And from 2005 to 2009, he took out bogus life insurance policies on bogus people and staged bogus funerals, which they didn't bill to real insurance companies. Now, these two elderly women, with the help of two middle-aged women, created elaborate backstories for their dead ringers. Like Jim Davis, a contractor who suffered a fatal heart attack at his home April 2nd, 2006. Crump and Schillings forged all the necessary documents and hired a young woman to play Davis's niece and collect from the insurance companies. When the claims adjuster showed up at Davis's ceremony, it looked as real as any funeral. Crump and Schillings even buried Davis's empty casket. For that little charade, they got a $1.25 million. But the claims adjuster suspected something might be a little off, so they hired a private investigator. When Crump and Schilling found out, they exhumed the empty coffin to have it cremated. To make sure it weighed the correct amount at the crematorium, so as not to alert the workers, the women filled it with animal bones, raw meat, and a mannequin. Well, by this time, the FBI was involved. Agents found the doctor who signed the bogus death certificates. He agreed to cooperate and seek their recorded Crump and Schilling, offering him $50,000 per policy to keep the scam going. Well, at this point, the jig was up. At the trial, Crump, who was wearing all white, claimed through her lawyer It was Schilling who masterminded the whole thing, and Crump herself only made $12,000. Unconvinced, the judge sentenced her to a year and a half in prison. As for Schilling, she claimed she'd renounced her fraudulent ways and was helping a young woman stay out of crime. She told the judge, "I hope to continue helping people and shining a different light on our community." She got 2 years. Well, Dave Berry made a comment that I find very appropriate. The Sixth Amendment states if you're accused of a crime, you have the right to a trial before a jury of people too stupid to get out of jury duty. And he's absolutely right. And let's turn to the Kansas City Star. On its July 30th Family Fun page, the Kansas City Star ran a blurb on National Clown Week. Accompanying the text, naturally enough, was the photo of a clown. But the editor selected the foul photo and neglected to look at the other side, which would have revealed the clown in question was John Wayne Gacy, a Chicago serial killer and one-time clown executed 5 years before for killing 33 boys and young men. Well, the next day, the Star carried an apology from the editor. Officials and patrons at the Ada County Library in Boise, Idaho, were perplexed by a bizarre series of crimes in 2009 and 10. Somebody was dumping ketchup, mustard, mayonnaise, even syrup into the book drop box. After dozens of books had been damaged, police staked out the drop box and busted Joy Cassidy, 74, with a jar of mayonnaise in her car. Now, clearly, riding around with a jar of mayonnaise proved that you had nefarious ideas. Her motive was unknown, but the police did say she was mentally competent enough to stand trial. She pled guilty. I guess the law did catch up with her. 1999, three of the 20th century's most notorious criminals were housed in a high-security federal prison in Colorado. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, and Ramzi Youssef, the 1993 World Trade Center bomber, collectively responsible for 177 deaths. 23 hours of each day, these men spent in solitary confinement, but for 1 hour they shared the same outdoor recreation time in a concrete courtyard. Separated by wire cages, not allowed to make eye contact, the three terrorists nevertheless did become friends. Although Kaczynski didn't agree with McVeigh's crime, he later said on a personal level, "I like Tim, and I imagine most people would like him." So what did they talk about? Well, Youssef's lawyer said they don't discuss how to make a bomb. For the most part, they talk about what they saw on Turner Classic Movies. Well, at the behest of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, I knew his daughter-in-law. She was a strange woman. Daniel Ellsberg, a RAND Corporation and Department of Defense analyst, compiled a top-secret study of U.S. decision-making from 1945 to 1968 in the lead-up to the Vietnam War. This 7,000-page study revealed a series of presidential failures and public deceptions regarding Vietnam and left Ellsberg deeply disillusioned. A summa cum laude graduate of economics in Harvard and a former U.S. Marine infantry commander, Ellsberg made photocopies of the report and turned them over to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1969 in hope of altering the course of the war. Lawmakers, of course, refused to act. When nothing happened and the fighting escalated, Ellsberg leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers in 71 to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and 17 other newspapers. Their publication was the beginning of the end of public support for the war. The Nixon administration, in an attempt to muzzle and threaten Ellsberg, created a secret team known as the Plumbers, who broke into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in L.A. to search for his medical records. Subsequently, the administration filed espionage charges against Ellsberg that carried a 115-year prison term. Because of the break-in and an attempted bribery of the judge, though, a federal judge dismissed the case. 1972, the infamous Plumbers carried out the Watergate burglary of the National Democratic headquarters, which led to the conviction of several White House aides and the resignation of Nixon. Well, we've come to the end of another show. I'll be back tomorrow night when, once again, we'll be talking about stories of the strange and the unusual. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.